Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is returning host Matt Skuda.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Hi, you want to tell everyone there again who you are and where people can hear you?
Right, so I work kind of freelance production in Los Angeles. I'm also a writer. People can find kind of what I've been up to in terms of like extracurricular work at mattskuda.com. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
You were on a long time ago for The Giver, which is another young adult fiction that was not around when I was in high school. And now we're going to turn to Madeline L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time, which definitely was around when I was in high school, although I read it in middle school. What time did you read this book?
Last week.
You haven't read it before?
I had not.
Oh, okay. You were the one who suggested it, so...
No, a friend of mine is working on the new movie.
Ah.
And so I had a little bit of interest in learning a little bit more about it.
This book was published in 1963, a few years before I was born. And anyone who went to school in the 70s knows it by the crazy... sort of psychedelic op art cover that was done by Ellen Raskin, the original designer, that I love very much. But then somewhere, I think in the late 70s, early 80s, it got the trippy centaur flying through the air cover that I think a lot of people younger than me remember. You don't have any emotional associations with this book. What was it on your cover?
So the cover I bought was from Barnes & Noble. It's kind of part of their Looks Good on the on Your Shelf collection.
Oh, right.
So it's the it has the first three books in the series, and it is a centaur with wings. And it's also a version... It has like some motifs from the first edition cover, like those circles. So it kind of has those circles plus a centaur.
This was L'Engle's major work. I think that anyone who knows Madeline L'Engle knows her from this book primarily, although it was the first book of a quintet of books. When I was a kid, it was only three books, and I read all three of those. And I gather that the child of the two major characters of this book went on to have her own series of books after this. I'm not familiar with anything past the first three books, so I guess I'll have to go back and look into that. It was a famously difficult book to get published. L'Engle wrote all her life, but only got published late in life, in her late 40s, which is a great comfort to people like me who have yet to publish a book, you know, our middle age, so... I guess I can look to her for inspiration.
No, definitely.
Since we don't have much in the way of backstory here, since you haven't read this before, I'm just going to launch into a quick plot summary here, and then we can kind of pick this apart and talk about it as both a book that you're reading now and as a book you might imagine a precocious kid reading in middle school. A Wrinkle in Time begins with our heroine, teenager Meg Murray, who has big problems in school with being bullied and shunned, and also her dad has been missing for about a year and is presumed either dead or run off with a woman. It's not really clear because absolutely nobody is talking about it. Also, there's a hobo who seems to be following her. But she does have a younger brother, Charles Wallace, who's a genius and who knows a crazy old woman named Mrs. Wetsit, who turns out to be Meg's hobo, and who also tells Meg's mom that there is such a thing as a tesseract. When Calvin O'Keefe, the most popular jock at school, shows up on a hunch, Meg, Charles Wallace, and he are whisked away on an interdimensional adventure by Mrs. Wutsit and her equally eccentric pal, Mrs. Who only speaks in quotations, as well as the mysterious Mrs. Witch, who doesn't seem to have a body. Traveling by the aforementioned Tesseract, which is the titular wrinkle in time, the three children and the three Mrs. W's end up on the planet Uriel, where the three W's reveal their true forms as centaur angels and or X-stars, and explain that they're going to help reunite Meg with her dad. Because things aren't crazy enough already, they wrinkle over to another planet in Orion's belt and meet a being called the Happy Medium, who helps fill in the backstory. It turns out that Mr. Murray, Meg's dad, had been exploring Tesserang himself when he got trapped on a planet in the thrall of a dark force called It, which in this case is not Pennywise the Clown, but the same force of evil that humanity's great scientists, artists, and religious figures have been fighting like forever. Finally, the kids are sent along on their own to the planet Kamazots, where everyone must be exactly the same, and where life is a sea of suburban cul-de-sacs. There they meet a man with glowing red eyes who takes them to see their dad, who's trapped in a tube, and It, which turns out to be a big pulsating brain. Charles Wallace becomes hypnotized by It, but Mr. Murray is able to wrinkle Meg and Calvin away to yet another damn planet called Ixthiel, whose furry, tentacled inhabitants treat Meg for space sickness. The three W's give Meg a pep talk, and she returns to Kamazots alone to save Charles Wallace with the power of love. Meg herself tesseracts back to Earth to reunite with Calvin and her family, and the three W's, who disappear in a convenient puff of smoke. So, is okay. That it?
That was nice and coherent.
Reading this book through again, I forgot just how zany this book is when it comes to geography. I mean, it's kind of built into the plot line, because one of the major plot points of the book is that it is possible to travel from any point in space to any other point of space simply by tessering. It's never quite explained what the mechanism is for that. It's sort of like, once you're aware that it's possible, you can do it. And because of that, geography doesn't really matter so much in this book. You know, they go from planet to planet and place to place, and it was a little hard for me to remember where they were at any given moment.
Yeah, no, I had the same thing when I was going through this, and I kept kind of having to kind of reset myself and go, okay, where are they again? Why are they doing it? And the three W characters, I kind of had trouble with them as well in terms of kind of guiding you through the story.
Yeah.
To be honest, they reminded me quite a bit of like Gandalf from The Hobbit. He's there. He's like, okay, you guys need to go on this specific journey, and then I'm going to leave so that it's adequately challenging for a book.
It's interesting you compare it to Gandalf, because of course, as Tolkien nerds know, Gandalf turns out to be one of these crazy stand-ins for angels that Tolkien was writing about, that mythical creatures come to Earth to help humanity and, well, other creatures like elves and dwarves. It's that tradition of, say, the Odin character who's going to show up at your door and look like a beggar in rags and then turn out to be a divine being. And I think that throughout this book, that's one of the major themes that gets redeveloped again and again, is you can't really know who someone is by looking at them, or you shouldn't make assumptions about who someone is by looking at them, whether it's the Mrs. Wutsit, or even someone like Calvin, who on the surface would seem to just be like a popular kid, but turns out to have a sensitive soul.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And with just about every character, even the creatures they're meeting, where perception is such a big part of it, and perception, Or like the way you see someone, like you see Calvin as just a jock, and like you said, turns out he's a kid with a kind heart, and he's very thoughtful about the world around him. Or you have these three women who turn out to be magical centaurs, or you have the tentacle monsters, like you said, who don't really speak in any meaningful way, but communicate kind of telepathically. So it's almost like what they're doing, their feelings are beyond human perception.
When you talk about the three W's, and you talk about Mrs. Watson, I think Mrs. Watson is a much more interesting character to me in her crazy hobo crone character than she is when she's revealed to be this beautiful centaur creature. It seems clear to me that Langle is reaching for effect when she describes the W's revealed in their sort of their godheads, that she's trying to paint a picture of something that's sort of indescribably beautiful. And the trouble with that is what she finds indescribably beautiful and what I find indescribably beautiful are quite different. I'm sort of less interested in these flying centaurs than I am in these crazy old women running around the place spouting quotations and such. I find that much more amusing.
Yeah, no, and all, again, still kind of on this subject, I find it frustratingly ironic for like kind of a book that many times touches on the unimportance of words or the lack of strength words have to describe certain things while being a book. That, you know, the idea is a novel is supposed to be able to describe these indescribable things. And for me, there's something very ineffective about describing something as indescribable.
But I will say this book has some incredibly arresting visionary scenes. I think everyone who has read this book when they were a kid, they may have forgotten everything else about the book, but they will remember when the children first arrive on the dark planet and come to this crazy suburban neighborhood where all the children are playing in synchronicity. They're all bouncing balls at the same moment. And it's so strange and so weird and beautiful. It's telling that is a sequence that they chose to highlight in the trailer for the new movie, because I think that's one of those scenes that everyone wants to see how it's dealt with.
Below them, the town was laid out in harsh angular patterns. The houses in the outskirts were all exactly alike, small square boxes painted gray. Each had a small rectangular plot of lawn in front, with a straight line of dull-looking flowers edging the paths to the door. Meg had a feeling that if she could count the flowers, there would be exactly the same number for each house. In front of all the houses, children were playing. Some were skipping rope. Some were bouncing balls. Meg felt vaguely that something was wrong with their play. It seemed exactly like children playing around any housing development at home. And yet there was something different about it. She looked at Calvin and saw that he, too, was puzzled. "Look," Charles Wallace said suddenly. "They're skipping and bouncing in rhythm. Everyone's doing it at exactly the same moment." This was so. As the skipping rope hit the pavement, so did the ball. As the rope curved over the head of the jumping child, the child with the ball caught the ball. Down came the ropes. Down came the balls. Over and over again. Up, down, all in rhythm, all identical, like the houses, like the paths, like the flowers.
And there are other scenes. I think that Mrs. Watson, in her first appearance, is quite interesting, and when they first come to the tentacled monsters, I think that they are described very well. I think that when Langle takes the time to try to describe things, she does very well. I think that when she throws up her hands and says, "Oh, this is ineffable," I myself have a hard time caring.
Right. Yeah, no, it makes sense. I think ultimately I agree with you.
Now, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to color anyone's perceptions here that all my opinions about this book is bad. This book is one of those books that when you read it at a certain time in your life, it's very formative. I think for a few reasons. I think there is this at its core, the idea of explaining what is now a fairly well understood concept that the three dimensions of space are only a few of the proposed dimensions that are out there. In this book, they give the fourth dimension as time, and they don't quite explain how it is that one positions oneself outside of those dimensions to circle around them. But that idea that there could be any number of dimensions beyond the ones that are perceived, and that we could travel through them, is, if you read this when you're like 11, it really sticks mm-hmm. with you. That really, it really gets into your head and sticks with you. Now, as an adult, where I'm, you know a little bit about string theory and stuff and what current cosmology is of things, I get frustrated because I don't feel like this book actually ever takes sort of seriously that premise, that it's sort of like once you understand this premise, somehow magically you're able to walk around dimensions. It's never quite explained.
Well, so they're jumping through dimensions is like almost driven by the three W's, right? And the idea is that her father, or like the humans can't, like, this is kind of the way I saw it as being, like, the humans, the standard humans, they don't know how to access the fourth or fifth dimension, but her father discovered it, and it's these other beings that just inherently understand it. They move through the fifth dimension like we move through the third dimension, and I think it's just something that is, again, not explained from, like, a technical standpoint, but is something that, like, Meg and Charles Wallace kind of learn from these three W's who just know how to do it because that's how they've existed for millions of years.
Maybe I just wasn't paying enough attention. It seemed to me at the end, once Meg is able to break Charles Wallace free from the thrall of it, she instigates the tesser that takes them back to Earth. I felt that was what the implication was. I mean, there's a lot of, in this book, there's a lot of people playing hunches. You know, Calvin shows up because he says all through his life he's had these kinds of intuitive feelings that he has to do something. And so that's the only reason he's here to have this adventure in the first place, is he had this intuitive idea that he had to show up at Mrs. Wetzel's house. And Meg is able to free Charles Wallace because she has love that she can give to him. Again, that's a feeling she has, and sort of like willing it so breaks him free, and then kind of riding that wave of agency, she's able to also get them off the planet and back to Earth. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
that's what I read as well. But I'm just saying, like, maybe she figured it out. I don't know.
Now, you sound a little bit less...
Ultimately, does.
You sound a little more down on this than I am. Did you not enjoy the book?
I was so ready to like this book. I really was. And before I read it, I expressed to the co-host of the Huck Finn episode, Jelani, that I was about to read this book. And he had not very nice things to say about it at all. And I thought it was over the top and unnecessary. And I was like, well, I think I'm going to like it. It sounds really interesting to me. And then as I was reading it, I realized how much I unfortunately agreed with him. I really wish I read this in fourth grade. Like, this book was bouncing around my fourth grade class, and everyone was super into it and loving it and talking about it. And I don't know why I didn't allow myself to read it and join the conversation. But I did whatever cover we had, which I think we spoke about before we recorded. The one that was in my classroom was from the early 90s or late 80s. And that was a cover I enjoyed quite a bit, but I don't know why I didn't read it. And I think this would have been one of my first, if I had read this in fourth grade, would have been one of my first pieces of media that dealt with kind of this interdimensional travel. And I think I would have found it fascinating and interesting. So I am disappointed that I'm reading it so late in life, because I think I found it more tedious, and longer than I wish I did.
Well, now that we've got everyone down here, let me try and bring us back up with a couple of things that...
Sorry.
No, it's fine. I just want to say a couple things that I do really admire about the book. One thing that's interesting about this book is Langle, as you read this book, it becomes very apparent that Langle's purpose is theological. She's very religious, and she has this kind of this vision of the cosmos being a struggle between good and evil, that the instance of religion that happens on the earth is simply one aspect of this cosmic struggle that goes on. She does speak specifically about Jesus in this book, which is interesting. I think it's fascinating because you don't often get books like this that treat religion seriously, but she's not treating religion in the sort of the very prosaic and rote way that I think a lot of Christian books like the Left Behind books do. She's imaginative and poetic and very idiosyncratic.
And that the religion was always speaking. Jesus was mentioned first in like a string of other philosophers and religious figures. And so I felt like in this book, even though like I think two different, or at least one religion, one passage from the New Testament is invoked in the book. But I thought that Christianity was treated kind of along with the philosophies of the world and not as something specific or different necessarily. And that was something I enjoyed and liked about it as well.
When I was reading about the history of this book, one of the things that fascinated me was the fact that a lot of this book was coming along around the time that there was starting to become a market for fiction aimed at religious people. You know, the Zondervan book stuff would come along in the 70s and stuff. And a lot of religious bookstores refused to carry this book. They saw it because they saw her work as being sort of heretical, insofar as Langle has a very inclusive idea of religion. She doesn't believe, for example, in eternal damnation. She believes that there's good in the universe and that it will ultimately win, and that ultimately everyone will be redeemed by that good. And that made her some, you know, get her a lot of critics in the fundamentalist world of religious publications. On the other hand, mainline books for kids, which tend to try to not deal with religion because it's seen as not a subject that is a safe one to deal with, she was treated as like, huh, who's this crazy author who's combining theology with science fiction? So I have a certain admiration for her following her muse on this. I think it's a brave book in that way. And the other thing I would say is I do, reading this through again, the one person that I love very much is Meg. I think she's a well-drawn character. She's awkward. She's full of self-doubt. She is smart, but she's not smart. She's not like a caricature of what a smart person is. She's like an actual... She strikes me as very real in a way that, for example, Charles Wallace does not strike me as real. She strikes me as a sensitive, awkward, well-meaning kid. But Charles Wallace is presented in what I would call... There's a tradition in romance fiction, and here I'm talking about like the medieval romantic fiction of Arthurian legends, of what's called a wise child, who's always sort of a supernatural being who appears as a child but knows things that a child should not know and is clever in a way that a child should not be clever. I think the other analog that most people would be familiar with would be Pearl in the Scarlet Letter. The character who is just too smart for a kid that age. And Charles Wallace is presented as this genius, but it's like a genius that doesn't actually exist in the world. He's constantly like quoting the Oxford Dictionary, and like nobody quotes the Oxford Dictionary. That's weird.
Well, and in addition to just quoting the Oxford Dictionary, he also has this, and I think you're right, like you didn't use this phrase, but you know, children who are intelligent are sometimes given like they're said to be like wise beyond their years. And that's not like what Charles Wallace comes across. I mean, he, like you said, he just absolutely doesn't exist. He's quoting the dictionary, but he's also so overly perceptive of the emotions of the people around him that, you know, the characters initially like, interpret that as just intelligence, but as like his psychic ability or like his shining or whatever.
Yeah, that's a good thing to say, the shining. It's very like that. It's sort of like having a certain amount of sensitivity gives superpowers to these kids.
These characters who have this ability in the book, like they're constantly absorbing their like their surroundings. And before we realized that's what Charles Wallace was doing, like Charles Wallace was a much more difficult character for me to get behind. But once they started kind of going into, oh, he's a psychic kid, I'm like, okay, fine, I'm with this now.
I would say the other thing about Charles Wallace that drives me up a wall is he's relentlessly nice in a way that I find just artificial and frustrating. He speaks with elocutions like he tells his sister, oh, I should like to kiss you very much right now, or oh, let me put my arms around you, dear sister. He's saintly in a way that makes no sense, except if you view him as a sort of an allegorical figure in some way. And I don't know exactly what that allegory would be. I mean, he puts himself on the line for his father, sacrificing himself to be taken into it in his father's stead. Again, it's not very clear why that happens or why this malevolent force agrees to swap out Charles Wallace for the father, except maybe Charles Wallace has these powers that it wants to take in, or maybe it just delights in the corruption of good characters. I don't know, but
Like that was, again, there's like another thing where it's the in terms of the swap, where you are trying to find this deep meaning, and hopefully there is that I'm missing, and maybe you're seeing it, but that's like an unfortunate. The character needs to do this for the plot, and I didn't really like the kind of the double rescue. Like, it was like, we're there to save the dad. Okay, we've saved the dad, but now we've lost Charles Wallace. And then rescued number two for Charles Wallace. But I guess it is important in that Meg is, in her rescue of Charles Wallace, in addition to, we kind of talked about her being an outsider at the beginning, she expresses to her mom that she wants to be, she wants to be conformed. She wants everyone to be the same so she can fit in. And obviously this crazy planet of conformity run by it or IT, or I was calling him IT. and is like, you know, the hyper, like, it's like the monkey's paw version of that. It's like, I want to fit in with all these people. It's like, well, here's a planet where everyone's exactly the same because they're controlled by a central intelligence that's doing that. And then ultimately when it comes down to saving Charles Wallace, she is told she needs to save him with something that only she has in that world. And that thing that only she has is, as we already said, love. So I think it worked in that respect, but I thought a little bit too much time was spent with the initial saving of the father, because the going back and saving Charles Wallace felt so similar in the kind of the way it was brought to.
Yeah, and this is where what I mentioned earlier about how, given the basic mechanic of tessering in and out of scenes, the machinations of the plot become very strange, because typically geography is a major obstacle in books. You know, if we go back to Gandalf, for example, for a minute here, the problem is getting the ring to Mount Doom is a very difficult thing to do. But when you can sort of blink in and out of places, then the things that are preventing you from achieving your goals aren't as clear. You know, it never is. The rules of what's keeping Charles in one place or another aren't ever made that clear. They say we can't take Charles away because now that it has control over him, it might destroy his brain or something. That's all conjecture on their part.
No, I think you're right. I'm trying to think of other examples where the characters make an assumption that makes it more exciting, that there's no other textual evidence to suggest that's the case.
When talking about like relentlessly nice people, the other person that I found kind of weird this time reading it through, because it's been a long time since I read this book, was Calvin. There's a part of me that really likes the fact that Calvin is there mostly as a cheerleader for Meg. I think that's a very important role to play, because so frequently in books, there's a male lead and the female character is just there to provide an ego boost or to give them motivation to do what they need to do, or to reveal that they had this secret in them all along, you know, whatever. And Calvin kind of plays that role for Meg. He's kind of there to give Meg the confidence to do what she needs to do. I like that a lot in a way, but Calvin himself is kind of an oddball. He's constantly calling everyone around him old sport.
yeah.
Which I don't think even in 1963 that was something people would do. I mean, that sounds like something people might do in, I don't know, 1910 or something. But
no, I had the same thought. It's like another one of those things where you have this character who feels so. This is not intended to be a pun. Like out of time.
Yeah.
It's like, for me, Calvin feels less allegorical than Charles Wallace. So there's kind of weird aspects of him. And I'm trying to imagine like a jock in, you know, the 1950s, 1960s, and, you know, movies being my only context for that, saying like old sport.
Well, I mean, if you read the rest of the books, eventually Meg and Calvin grow up and marry. And, you know, there is this kind of a proto romance in this book. And what's nice about this is Calvin fulfills a certain wish fulfillment fantasy here. If we as readers are supposed to identify most closely with Meg, and I do believe we are supposed to identify most closely with Meg as the awkward, insecure, unsure, sensitive person who is sent reluctantly on this mission into the world. Then we see Calvin as this kind of a beautiful boy who you always sort of assumed was out of your league, and then suddenly it turns out that he has the same interior life that you have, that he's just as sensitive and just as uninterested in conformity and in pleasing the world. It's kind of having it both ways.
Well, I think it is like, it is kind of like a, from like a lesson standpoint, like thinking that this is like a book for someone in fifth grade. So like Meg, who feels like this outcast character, and she thinks she has all these problems and all these feelings and all these desires that are so specific to her and her outsideness. And we meet this character who's like out of her league or whatever, but is like in a different type of group. He's the jock. And she has this perception of him before she gets to know him, and she learns that he has similar hardships or concerns about life in general, or similar desires and similar feelings. And I think it kind of humanizes the other, and I think in a not very clean way, but I think in an important way. And I think whether overtly or not, I think if you read this as a young student, it may change your perception of like other cliques around you. I don't know.
Both Charles Wallace's constant quotations from the dictionary, but also Mrs. Hu's constant quotations, usually from classical sources, sometimes from Shakespeare, sometimes from the Bible. That is a tradition in children's literature of dipping kids into the world of great ideas. And I think that a book like even, say, The Phantom Tollbooth is a book that does that in a much more wry, silly way. But this introduction, this gentle introduction to these great works, this reminds me also of when I read Fahrenheit 451 early on for this podcast. Bradbury spends a lot of time in that book promoting the idea that these characters are intellectuals because they know their classical sources, you know, and it's mm-hmm. It's so funny to me that in mid-century American writing, the way you establish that something is intellectual is you quote, you know, a Roman source or something like that. That seems like nobody would do that anymore. Maybe I'm wrong. I didn't go to a Latin school. My kids both went to Latin schools, so maybe they know more Cicero than I do.
No, that's a good point in terms of kind of like the shorthand for intelligence. Again, like you said, is like knowing Latin or Roman source.
Yeah.
I'm trying. Can you think of any like modern shorthands of sophistication?
I don't know. I think that modern shorthands. I think that modern stories for kids, the smart kid is the kid who knows everything there is to know about TCP/IP. You know, who knows how to network, and who you know. I remember if you read Little Brother by Cory Doctorow, which was a recent young adult novel, there the characters all talk about building their own networks and setting up free Wi-Fi or running pirate software off their Xboxes. And I think that there's a kind of an emphasis upon technology as the shibboleth for being a smart kid. And mm-hmm. But it's a little harder now because you have to assume that the kids actually know a little bit about what you're talking about. You can't just fake it.
That's a good point. So I like the idea that you're saying, like the idea of modern sophistication is like being plugged in.
Right.
So because when you said that, the first thing that came to mind was like Ready Player One and Snow Crash.
Sure.
as being like the kind of the transcendent characters. The characters you kind of expect to lead you through this world are ones that just have this unbelievable understanding of the digital world. And a lot, and weirdly, this doesn't necessarily relate to the sophistication in Wrinkle in Time, but the plugged in aspect, like the, you know, the World Wide Web, or the the running through wires kind of exists as this other dimension, not super unlike what we see in Wrinkle in Time. Because I should have looked it up, but when I was reading Wrinkle in Time, there is a Fairly Odd Parents episode. It might have been like an early TV movie of that television show that I watched when I was younger. That had some imagery in it that I thought of as I was reading like the cookie cutter suburbia what you see in this book. And that was a like digital dimension. So I like that connection.
A pop culture version of an intelligent character today is less likely to make reference to great books and more likely to have a conversancy with pop culture and to make the references from sort of high and low sources. And that's seen as a mark of sophistication, is whether or not you can relate, you know, what you're doing right now to a scene from a Quentin Tarantino film or, a Bazooka Joe comic, and it's sort of like everything's up for grabs. Whereas in this book, I think there is certainly a hierarchy of culture, partly because if you take seriously this idea that there is a darkness out there, and that darkness is somehow conformity or lack of agency, lack of autonomy, and she lists the people who are fighting against it as scientists and poets and artists and religious figures, she really wants to hold up what we would, you know, call the traditional Western canon as those people who are doing the greatest work in fighting back, you know, kind of ironically in a way, because today we, in a kind of a more multicultural, anti-canonical world, people see that Western civ tradition as itself being sort of a conformity-producing system.
I agree. That was something that kind of talks about the, well, like, you know, like you said, the darkness being like the lack of philosophy, art, or religion in this world. And how, like, certain types of art forms are very, I mean, the reason different types of art exist is because you're conforming to a style, you're conforming to a movement, or like a religion. Depending on the religion, it's incredibly specific, and it gets so specific that it lacks like inclusiveness, where I think, like you said, this book is unique in that it preaches, is not a word I want to use, but I'm going to use it, preaches, inclusiveness, and individual, and it seems to promote a lot of things that aren't. This book promotes a philosophy and movements, whether it's, like you said, art, philosophy, or religion, that don't necessarily promote the philosophy of this book. And I thought that was, it's not a bad thing, but I thought it was kind of interesting.
Yeah, no, that is interesting. And the other thing that is interesting to consider is why is Meg so convinced that she's such an outsider in the first place? You know, I read a little bit about Lengel's history, and she herself felt bullied as a child. She moved from school to school because of the family situations, and she went to boarding school, she had governesses, she kind of I think she felt like an outsider, and I think she was trying to draw from that feeling when she was writing Meg. But ultimately, it's sort of like, well, Meg, you know, I hate to say it, but Meg's problems are kind of generic. They're in the way that I think all of us, when we're in high school, feel like we're the nerd, that we're the one nobody likes.
But and we're the intelligent one. The teachers don't get us. The principal hates us because they think we're troublemaker, but we're really just trying to be the best, or not be the best, but be who we are while being against the system, but wanting to take as much as you can from it.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, if you actually did run into a Charles Wallace, you would think that they were pretty weird, and you would wonder what was going on. It's been a long time since I read the other books in the series, but I remember A Wind in the Door, the second book, being a book that I found much more involving when I was a kid. The storyline follows the fact that Charles Wallace has become ill, and Meg has to take a trip down to Charles Wallace's anatomy, into his mitochondria, actually. And he actually, the mitochondria turn out to be sentient beings that relate to Meg in the book. And part of why I realize now that I like that book better is that Charles Wallace is kind of put out of action for that book. Because he's the one who's sick, and he doesn't get to take part in this adventure. So that I kind of like.
He's the guy on the table in Fantastic Voyage.
Right, right. Now I'm probably forgetting everything else about the book, but that book was the book that taught me what mitochondria are. So that's the thing about these books in this series is Langle is great at encapsulating one big idea for kids, and those big ideas are fascinating when you're a kid. I remember being fascinated by the idea of a tesseract. I remember being fascinated to learn that inside our body we have these little organelles that nobody knows how they got there or why, but they are crucial to our lives, and they seem to be separate in some way from us. You know, those things did stick with me, and I think the character of Meg did stick with me. I don't want to be too down on this book, because I think it is a very dreamy book, and like I said, if you read this when you're about 10 or 11, it hits you like a ton of bricks.
And like I said, I really wish I did. Like that's kind of how I felt like the entire time, and I think even rereading it now, had I read it before, I think I, you know, I could have recalled things at work. See, that was the thing with when we read The Giver. It was a book I had read before. It was a book you had not. And I think you kind of came away liking it quite a bit less than I did. But I could see it's, I was able to kind of look through my perception now and kind of recall the appeal I saw in it at the time.
Yeah.
And that's something I'm having more trouble doing with this because I didn't read it at the time.
You mentioned that you have a friend who's working on the new film that's coming out.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen the trailer for the film. Who's the director is what? Ava.
Ava DuVernay.
Ava DuVernay, and the trailer looks absolutely stunning. And I think the reasons that the trailer is interesting to me is it makes concrete a lot of what is very fuzzy in the book. The Mrs. W characters are played by like Oprah Winfrey, Reese Witherspoon, and Mindy Kaling, who are all these great characters, and that seems to me like, again, a very strong choice to go ahead and make these characters very strongly distinct. So I have a lot of interest in seeing this film.
I do too, and I think given how this book is several decades old, I think there's a lot of opportunity to also update the children characters, maybe relate more to our character, to, like, you know, children of 2017. And because I'm not a child of 2017. I'll be curious to see what decisions they make.
Do you have any scoops you can give us from the set with your friend there, or not? You didn't really learn anything there.
I really don't have any scoops, and if I did, I also don't want to get this guy in trouble. I think the only thing I wanted to talk about that we didn't, now that I'm seeing it, but okay. So the opening line of this book is, "It was a dark and stormy night," and like that's kind of a cliche, and so I was kind of annoyed that. So initially I was like, "Oh come on, that's kind of a cheap way to begin a book," but then I was like, "Oh, maybe this is the first book that did that." It's again was written quite a bit before I was born. So I looked into it. Like the first time that was used was in a book called Paul Clifford, which is a novel by, I'm going to say his name,
Bulwer Lytton.
Edward Bulwer Lytton. Yes. Yeah, I was worried about Lytton.
Yeah, yeah.
So I looked into that book to pull up the very unfortunately brief Wikipedia page, and I was trying to see if there are any broad themes that we could connect to Wrinkle in Time. And because that's basically a book about like a criminal during the French Revolution who's arrested and tried by his father, eventually escaping with a girl. So, I don't know. With those broad strokes, I don't think there were a lot of connections I could make.
Well,
what about you?
Well, here's the thing. I actually spent a while talking about this with my wife because this is the sort of thing we talk about when we drive places. It was a dark and stormy night is a famously cheesy opening line, and yes, it all goes back to Bulwer Lytton, and there's actually a contest called the Bulwer Lytton Fiction Contest where people are supposed to come up with the worst opening line that they can, and it's held every year, and it's quite funny if you look at them online. When you quote something that's that self-consciously cliched, it seems to be a signal to the reader of something, and I don't know exactly what that is, a signal to the reader in this case. It could be a signal that this is a highly artificial story, that you need to, as a reader, treat this as something of a fairy tale, or treat this with the kind of an eye to the or an ear to the fact that it's not going to follow normal logic. The thing that's a little bit dangerous about it, of course, is that as a cliche, it is something of a joke. It was actually used a lot in Peanuts, where Snoopy would write novels and he would always start them with "It was a dark and stormy night." It seems like Lengel is running the risk of having us treat everything here with a little less seriousness. I don't know. It could also be just dropped in there as a very literary opening, like here's a wink to the readers who get it, you know, and I admit to being a little bit puzzled by it, because as an opening, if I were to open a book with that, it would be a clue to my readers to not take anything seriously.
Yeah, well, because, like, I mean, like, I think if that were written now, or if, like if I was, like, a high school English teacher, I feel like I'd read a lot of short stories that began with "There's a Dark and Stormy Night." Because it almost feels like a hacky way to start a book. But I really like your thought that it's like a version of Once Upon a Time. And that almost makes me like it better. Like, it's a way to begin a specific type of story, or it kind of carries this connotation of fairy tale or something.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing to think, because some of the squishiness of this book, the flakiness and the indeterminacy of what's going on, you can feel a little bit better about it when you feel like it's all being presented to you as something of a dream anyway.
Yeah, I think it certainly feels like a dream. In a lot of ways, like these, because my idea of this book, going on the cover alone, like even the one I saw back in my fourth grade classroom and the one I got from Barnes & Noble a few weeks ago, is so different from what the book actually is. And I don't think that affected my enjoyment or non-enjoyment of the book at all. But, like, the cookie cutter suburbia and the IT or it and the people with red eyes and almost the, it's not really bureaucratic, but it's not capitalistic either. I'm trying to think of like a good way to describe this, this society run by the IT. And you're gonna have to cut this because I totally lost my train of thought.
That's okay. Just take your time. Say whatever you want to say. I'll cut it all.
No, I forgot it.
Okay.
I don't even remember where I began, but it was something about. Nope, don't have it.
Actually, that's
the dreamlike state. Yeah,
That's a very good quote for the cover of this book. I forgot it. I don't know where I began.
Yeah, no, it's I don't got it. I don't know where I began. Raves Matt Scooter. Okay.
Final judgments here. What do you think about this book? Would you recommend it to a friend? Would you recommend it to a kid?
I think I would definitely recommend it to a kid. I think definitely like late elementary school. I think fourth or fifth grade would be like a perfect time for this book, because I think kind of the themes you're introduced in. Or some of like the themes and concepts that are introduced would be, you'd be introduced to those before you'd be introduced to them at an age where you wouldn't have seen them in very many movies or even like video games or kind of whatever media you're into. And I think it's kind of a fun jumping off point. And I would have liked to have kind of had this book as a touchstone to go, oh, like I'm watching Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And it, because it's like invoking this like idea of like post World War II conformity of American suburbia, and then go like, okay, so Franklin Time did the same thing, and like when did it have the same goals, or how is it working with that? Like, I would have liked to have had this as a reference point before now, and I think it would have been a powerful one. So I don't think I would recommend it to any friends who are a similar age or older than me, or even like a teenager. I think I would definitely say elementary.
Thanks to co-host Matt Scuda. You can see more of what Matt's up to at mattscuda.com. Thanks for the reading to Christy Admiral. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. You can join the discussion online on the Facebook page, or members can join us on the Incomparable Membership Slack. Keep up your reading, and remember, everything will be on the final.